We've been talking this election season with first-time voters, from the formerly incarcerated to the newly 18 to people who just became citizens not long ago. Here's what a new citizen who immigrated from Romania has to say about the responsibility of voting. It's a responsibility she doesn't take lightly. Well, we don't have that clip, but here's what she says. She basically says that we like to call ourselves a democracy, but part of what it means to fulfill the responsibility of democracy is to elect informed leaders and also to do the research that allows us to perform that civic responsibility. So the responsibility, not just to vote if you can, but to do the work that makes you an informed voter. That means searching out answers to questions about candidates and ballot issues. It might also mean planning with coworkers to be sure you've got enough time. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking today about getting ready to vote. Do you have tried and trusted research methods or election day practices you swear by? Call 816-235-2888 to share them with us. 816-235-2888. Bryn Musser is here now. She has her own techniques, and we're going to talk about those. Hi, Bryn.
Hi.
So, as you began researching the ballot in Missouri, you tracked your progress in a Google Doc, which you ended up sharing on Facebook. Can you read your post?
Yeah. So, I just said, I researched every damn thing on this godforsaken ballot, wrote it all down in a Google Doc, and now you can have it because I love you.
So, based on the tone of that message, I take it this was not your idea of fun.
It could have been, but this is a really long ballot. So, I knew that going into a little bit, but I was shocked to see the amount of decisions on the ballot this time around. So I felt like if I was taking a long time to prepare my my votes, that I should probably share it with my friends and family too.
So when you say you did research, how did you do it?
It's hard because there's not a ton of information available, especially when you get over to like the judges and a lot of the candidates. And so it's hard to find reliable, credible information. So I did my best. I'm not an expert. I'm just a civilian citizen. So I kind of just Googled and I went down a bunch of rabbit holes and I used a few websites that I had been familiar with. Ballotpedia was one that I found really helpful, but really just kind of spending the time. I think it took me probably 20 hours to put the whole thing together.
Do you, when you were Googling, did you take some results as credible that turned up and others as not? And how did you determine that?
I think the things that when you type in, let's say, any of the amendments or any of the propositions, the first couple things you're going to see are going to be the websites in opposition to it and then the websites that are in support of it. I think looking at both of those is important to try to see who's funding it, what are some of the politicians that are behind it, and then kind of going from there. So looking at making sure that you're reading the pros and the cons of each and then making your own decision based on that.
So was there anything that you turned up that surprised you as you did your research? Something that you were either unaware of before or just as you dug deeper, things were not as they seemed?
I would say that I was shocked that I kind of got on a routine with a lot of the candidates. I got on a routine with my research for a lot of the amendments and propositions, but the judges were just an enigma to me. I didn't know where to find it, and it felt like they weren't trying to find me either. And so that was one of the frustrating parts, was thinking, I don't know how to answer these questions about whether or not they should be retained in office. But it's kind of like if you want my vote, come get my vote. Come talk to me. Come tell me what you're doing or like what you've been doing.
So you came from a place of, if you don't tell me, then I can't have the confidence to vote to retain you.
I don't know that that's reflected, but I think I agree with that sentiment. I feel like I want them to work a little harder to be transparent to us.
Interesting. We're going to get more on that pretty soon. But, you know, What I love about your whole journey creating this Google Doc through the research you did to cast your own votes, then sharing it on social media, you actually reshared a revised, I'll call it cheat sheet, after your initial post, because some of the feedback you received sent you back into research mode and you learned more because of it. Yep. And that, to me, is interesting, that the act of sharing your research ultimately was part of your preparation process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. That was really what I was hoping for. I actually never thought that this would get shared as many. I never thought this was going to be in front of the eyes of people that I don't know and love. So when that happened, I mean, I didn't know that this was going to be seen by so many people. So when it was, I was really happy that it sparked conversation. And that's really what I wanted out of it, was because I know I'm not an elected official. I'm not anything in the community necessarily, other than just like active and involved in somebody that cares about Kansas City a lot and Missouri. Yeah, I was really happy when it got so much feedback, because it was a chance for me to learn and grow more. And I've tried to edit based. I went back in, and if you see the first version versus the second version, you can see the edits, and then I changed the colors of some of the fonts so that you can see like how it evolved. And it really didn't change so much. The ones that I did change my mind on were ones that I was kind of like, I'm not quite sure. So it was really helpful to have this collaborative effort, and I think I'll definitely keep doing it.
You ended up with a ballot that could be summarized pretty much by just vote Democrat all the way down. And one of the comments on your post was basically, why do the research when you end up voting the party line? Does it feel like you might as well not have done the homework? Or does the process of researching and informing yourself have a value regardless?
Oh, I definitely think it has a value. You could say I voted Democrat for the most part. There was a time where I got to vote Green Party. I think I'm playing defense right now. I think that that might not ultimately always be the way that I vote. I would love to vote for really progressive candidates. I'd love to vote further left than I did. But I have two options usually. And I went with the ones that reflect the direct. I see this as a long game here. So in changing the way the people that hold power and the ways that power is wielded. So, I think it was really helpful. And I don't think that when it gets to some of the ballot initiatives and the amendments and the other parts of it, I don't know. And judges, too, aren't really partisan. So there was a whole chunk of the ballot that I didn't vote on party lines necessarily. I just went on information.
Call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about how you get ready to vote on KCUR's Central Standard. And Bryn, before I turn to our other guests, I do have one more question for you. Was there a piece of information you were seeking out and never succeeded in finding despite your best efforts?
I think that no matter how much we dig, I think unless we're having open conversations with the Jackson County Charter, I don't think I'm ever going to get down to the root of what is going on with questions 1 through 7 and kind of where they're really coming from. I think that there's part of it that...
Explain what questions 1 through 7 are.
Questions 1 through 7 are Jackson County ballot initiative. Well, even trying to explain them, I think it would be hard, but they're... To me, they seem like they're attempts to make maybe the Jackson County Charter less transparent, and it sounds like people might have a harder time, the public might have a harder time participating in the government operation. But there's part of me that thinks that it might just be dispute between the legislative and the executive branches over there. I'm not actually sure what's going on with them. And I'd be interested to know where they came from. I don't know much about them.
Okay, well, we're going to work on this. Okay. I want to bring in a couple more guests now, my esteemed colleagues here at the station, starting with Dan Margulies. Dan, you're formerly a newspaper guy. Once upon a time, the answer to all of these questions would be, Just read the newspaper. Read it every day, and then you will know the issues and the candidates like the back of your hand come voting time, right? Mm. Was that once upon a time the answer, or is that
something
an
like
oversimplification?
That. I think it's a bit of an oversimplification, Gina. Not entirely, certainly with respect to most of the issues and candidates that Brenna is talking about. But when it comes to judges, I don't think newspapers were a very good place to turn, except insofar as they might have written something about a particular judge because of a scandal or something like that. But in this respect, the internet has proved to be a great boon, because to answer Bryn's questions about who to vote for or retain as judges, the internet is a sort of a lifeline now for that. Because there are places, apparently you didn't find them, but there are places you can look to see how judges are regarded by the lawyers who appear before them. And we can get into that. That's all part of the Missouri Nonpartisan Court Plan, which has been imitated in many, many states.
It's what is that?
So the Missouri Nonpartisan Court Plan, otherwise known as the Missouri Plan, was enshrined in the Missouri Constitution. It dates to 1940, and it was an effort to get money and politics out of the whole business of putting judges on the courts. And, of course, this was a reaction to the Pendergast machine, which wielded inordinate influence in determining who would sit on the bench. And the idea was, as I say, to remove money and politics from the selection of judges and thereafter the retention of judges. And it's a plan that is not perfect. To paraphrase Winston Churchill on democracy, it's the worst system devised except for all the others. And, you know, it periodically runs into opposition from entrenched interests that want to make judges either entirely elected, which, by the way, remains the case in Missouri for downstate parts of the state. The Missouri Court Plan, I should make clear, applies only to the largest areas of the state, namely Jackson, Clay, and Platte counties, Greene County, which is Springfield, and St. Louis County and St. Louis City. That is where the Missouri Court Plan is in effect. Elsewhere in the state, judges are indeed elected.
Well, Dan, you have compiled a guide to sort of how to figure out what is the deal with these judges
right.
before you head to the polls. Can you give us sort of like the Cliff's Notes? This has been wildly popular online.
Yeah, it shocked me. I mean, I put together something, what we call here at KCUR a build-out, based on an appearance by two lawyers who talked about the Missouri Court Plan on Up to Date, our other talk show. And I thought maybe my wife and five other people would read it. And much to my amazement, it has, as we say, gone viral. And Cody here, who you have yet to introduce, explained to me that actually things like that are popular because people are looking for places to turn and learn these kinds of things. I guess I took it for granted that people would know, but they don't. So there are websites you can go to. The Missouri Bar has an excellent website where they provide evaluations based on judges' responses to surveys of all the judges who are up for retention in your particular district. And that website is called yourmissourijudges.org. And on the Kansas side here in the metro area, you can go to a website that is maintained by the Johnson County Bar Association, and that's jocobar.org, in which they similarly provide evaluations of the judges who are up for retention on the Kansas side.
So backing away from the judge thing for a second, we started this conversation, you and I, about newspapers and their role in making an informed decision at the polls. That role may be changing. Is the newspaper still a viable place to turn should you want to go there for your information? Can you just read the, can you just read the paper?
Well, I don't know that that's going to be of any help with respect to what we're talking about here, namely the retention of judges.
No, I mean in general.
Oh, in general, yes. I mean, I don't know how influential they are anymore, but certainly newspaper endorsements used to count for something, and I think they still count for something. Now, of course, a lot of people have their a priori dispositions and beliefs, and you know, if they believe, for instance, that the Kansas City Star is a quote-unquote liberal rag, then they'll discount their endorsements entirely. And on the other hand, if they think that the Kansas City Star going in before they even see the endorsements is a good source of information, then they will, you know, lend credibility to those endorsements. But, you know, insofar as judges are concerned, another way to learn about judges is simply, and this is responding to one of the things that Bryn raised, and I so admire your curiosity, your abiding curiosity, is, and very few people take the trouble to do this, but read some of the judges' opinions. Now, of course, trial court judges don't issue opinions very frequently, but the appeals court judges, that's what they do. And you can read their opinions and get a sense of what they're about from those opinions. I mean, that is really taking things to the extreme for people like Bryn, who, you know, want to learn the basics. And but if you're a real legal nerd like me, then you'll do that. Of course, I do it as part of my work, too.
Well, so I want to bring in Cody Newell. He is a bit of a younger staffer here at KCUR. He's done a
I
lot
resemble
of
that.
He's done a lot of our online voting guides in the past here at KCUR. And Cody, what do you think might be particular about how people your age go looking for answers before they vote?
Well, I think a lot of people my age don't look for answers before they vote. I'll just be honest. A lot of my friends will say, like, hey, man, like, I heard that there's like a bunch of weed things on the ballot. Like, what do you think about this? And they have like basically no knowledge of any of the specifics, which is fine. I don't think everybody has to be expected to know everything about it, you know, before Election Day. But yeah, I think it's tough sometimes.
I want to pause there. You don't think people need to know everything?
Or, well, okay, they should. But I don't have that expectation that everybody know every single thing and have the ins and outs of every single ballot measure, every single race, every single judge. You know, that's a lot to take on.
So, what do you think? Do people talk about what do you do on the questions where you don't know, where you don't have the information?
Do people ask me about questions that I don't know about?
No, do people talk about what they do at the polls when they don't know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know personally, like, to take the example of judges in the past, I've been like, I don't know who any of these people are. So I just say, like, okay, we'll just retain them all. I think in some cases, like, my roommates will just kind of say, like, well, I just left it blank because I wasn't really sure and I didn't really know how I felt about it, which is not a great way to go into an election, but it is what it is.
Okay, so, Dan, any response to this?
Well, you know, I mean, it is true that most voters, I dare say, go into the polling booth and they encounter all these names at the end of the ballot and they have no idea who they are and they're taken aback. They're surprised. By the way, that's one good reason to do advanced voting. You can, you know, bone up at your leisure. I mean, by mail, I'm talking about. You can bone up at your leisure and sit there and take all the time you want and there's no pressure. But I would say that in general, it is probably a reasonable assumption to make that a judge should be retained unless there is something so scandalous about that judge, whether extrajudicial conduct or judicial conduct, that warrants that judge's removal from the bench.
Call 816-235-2888 with your tricks and tips for being an informed voter and having a solid Election Day plan. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. When Central Standard returns, we'll get back to some of those calls, and we'll have some advice on how Cody Newell prepared our voting guides to begin with. How did he get his information? Stay tuned. We We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about preparing to vote. Do you have a plan? Have you learned from past mistakes what it means to really be ready? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. I'm here with KCUR's Cody Newell and Dan Margulies, as well as an area voter, Bryn Musser, who shared her research on candidates with friends on social media. Hi again, everyone.
Hello.
So, we were just talking over the break. Dan was just saying, you know, the sort of framework for maybe making a decision about retaining a judge or not, like how you even approach that decision. And he was saying that usually, barring judicial or extrajudicial conduct that sort of stands out as, wow, this judge did something irresponsible or unprofessional, whatever, that you would, that generally can just sort of assume it's okay, that person's doing a decent job. But Bryn, so you're having some second thoughts based on what Dan was saying about the little cheat sheet, as I'm calling it, that you put together.
Yeah, so my process, and to go back to a little bit about how I had my first iteration versus my revised cheat sheet for myself. I don't mean cheat sheet for everyone either. It's just this is how I was going to take it in. And I'll say that part of this is because when I used to vote in Longfellow neighborhood, I voted in the National Archives, and it was completely, I went to pull up my phone because there was a question that I had, and I had absolutely no service. And so I felt like I needed to take a physical paper down there with me. But anyway, so my first iteration of it, I was under the incorrect assumption that Missouri judges and local judges were appointed via what I understood about the process of the Supreme Court judges. So I thought that if I assumed that if our governor and our administration was conservative, that they would appoint similar leaning candidates or judges, excuse me. And then based on the conversations that came out of that first iteration, I was informed by somebody else that that's actually not the process, that we do have this judicial committee. It's nonpartisan. It has citizens involved in the process. So I went back through and kind of tried to base it on what did they do before they were appointed as a judge? What were some of the cases that they took? What were the way that they what were the ways that they judged those? And then also from the conversations, I got a lot of anecdotal stories from people in the community. And I was shared a number of stories about judges and people's experience with them presiding over their cases. And so that was also really informative for me, too. So I did end up changing my mind. But yeah.
Well, so, Dan, just some quick thoughts on this before we hear how Cody Newell has prepared voting guides, how he got his info.
I just wanted to say about Bryn that I am so blown away by how seriously you take your responsibilities as a voter. Would that every voter took their responsibilities as seriously as you do. Now, I mean, that you went to such great lengths to investigate the judges who are up for retention is just, to me, extraordinary. I mean, even I didn't do anything like that. All I will say is that yes, with regard to how judges are selected, they are selected by independent committees consisting, in the case of appellate judges, mm-hmm. Three citizens and three lawyers and the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In the case of trial judges on the Missouri side, the circuit court judges, they're selected by committees consisting of two lawyers, two lay people, and the chief judge of that appellate district. And then the governor and anybody can apply, and then those committees whittle it down to three nominees from whom the governor selects. So the idea, of course, of retention is to still leave voters with a chance to express their opinion so that it isn't, as some charge, an elite process that is mainly dictated by lawyers. And so, as I said before, you know, paraphrasing Churchill, it's not a perfect process, but it is the best one we have.
Okay, so stepping away from judges, and getting back into this broader issue of being ready to vote, Cody, you, as I've said in the past, have compiled KCUR's online voting guides. You are part of a generation, as you've said, where you don't think a lot of people are necessarily going through a rigorous process like Bryn's. What was your process being sort of a, I guess I would say, digital native who did have a hefty responsibility to really do your homework?
Well, it always started with going to whatever issue it was, going to the actual ballot language. That's like step one, is just read what's actually on the ballot and see if you can understand it for yourself. And most of the time, the ballot language is pretty simple or simple enough to understand. The next step, though, beyond that, is to really start looking into who's funding these different measures. And look into their politics, look into their ideology, look into what you think about that. And a huge resource, and I think Bryn mentioned this earlier, is Ballotpedia. I love that website because it lays out so much information, especially like an example, the medical marijuana measures on the ballot in Missouri this year. It lays out all three of them in this really handy table and gives you all of the differences on a number of different, like, you know, does this measure allow home growing of medical marijuana? Yes, no, maybe, you know, it's really, really useful. So the next step was always to hit up Ballotpedia, see what they had written about it. They're nonpartisan, as far as I know. I don't think they have any leaning. And so that was a really useful source. And then sort of the third step, and maybe this is a little bit counterintuitive as a person in news, but then I would hit up news sources, other public radio sources, to go ahead and be shameless. KCUR's own voter guides are really good, and we have a lot of them. So that was often sometimes a place that I would go for kind of a third step.
Cody Newell, thank you so much.
Yeah.
And Dan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Dan is a senior reporter and editor at KCUR. Cody is an audience development specialist at the station. And Bryn Musser is an area voter who's done a lot of research. Bryn, thank you for joining us today.
It was my pleasure.
Keep talking about this on Twitter at KCURCST. Up next, Susan Orlean. Her next book is about libraries. Stay tuned. The hardcover edition of Susan Orlean's new book doesn't have a book jacket. It's got a textured red cover, and the title across the front says simply, The Library Book, in gold type. It's a clever homage to library books everywhere, and I like to think, to the people who recognize this charmingly nondescript book as something familiar and lovable. Because even though the book smells new, when I see it, I'm practically inhaling the dust of every library book I've ever read. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now let's welcome Susan Orlean to KCUR's Central Standard. She's headed to Kansas City for a reading tonight. Hi, Susan.
So good to be with you.
There's a story about a library fire that's sort of the backbone of this book. Tell us about the fire that got you thinking about libraries.
The fire that I focused on was the largest library fire in the history of the United States. It took place in 1986. It burned the contents of the Los Angeles Public Library, the central branch of the LA Library, destroying 400,000 books and damaging 700,000 more. It was thought to be an arson and investigated as an arson. And it was a really devastating event. The library was closed for 7 years after this fire.
What was it about the story that caught your attention and made you want to dig in and learn more?
To begin with, the idea of books burning hit me as just so repulsive. And I was very curious about that. I mean, nobody looks at fire and thinks, oh, good, you know, there's a fire that's out of control. But there's something about books burning that really resonates. It's been a tool of oppressive regimes since the beginning of time. It's symbolically very meaningful to us. It's very emotional. What is it about books and libraries that affect us so profoundly? And why does an event like this strike me as being so horrible, something so, so devastating.
A big part of this is the story of the arsonist himself. There's something very haunting about him. I mean, of course, someone who sets a giant library on fire, there's something disturbing about that. But there's something haunting about his backstory.
He was a young man named Harry Peake who grew up in a town east of Los Angeles, dreaming of bigger things. He left home and moved to LA with the intention of becoming a movie star. He was somebody who was a compulsive liar. He was a dreamer. Everybody really liked him. He was a very charming guy, handsome. Everyone thought he was an endearing, immensely likable guy, and he also drove everyone crazy because he was incapable of telling the truth. He could never say, I had lunch, you know, at the taco stand. It would always be, I had lunch with Cher, or I had coffee with Burt Reynolds. Everything was always dramatic. Everything in his life was exaggerated and embroidered. And it made him, on one hand, to me, a sort of iconic figure of L.A., which is, of course, the land where fantasy comes to life. And in this case, this was someone who was living a life that was built of fantasy. What was strange is that he was unable to distinguish between the kind of attention that saying you had lunch with Cher would bring and the kind of attention that saying you had started a huge fire would bring. It was all about getting attention, and he was the one who began telling people that he had started the fire.
There's something about it that's very like, I know that it isn't this, but it feels almost like TV versus books. You know what I'm saying in this whole...
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, he was living a life that, or yearning for a life as packaged and presented through the medium of television or movies, this kind of amazing life where everything is just glamorous and fabulous and
a big spectacle.
And yes, everything is dramatic and a big story arc, as opposed to the subtlety that you might find in books.
You know, the other thing about the fire itself, before we move on to libraries, the thing about the fire itself that touched a nerve for me is the immediate aftermath of the fire. You've got this chapter all about how just utterly devastated and traumatized the librarians were who had to come back to the library even when it wasn't open.
It was, first of all, a huge task to empty the library after the fire. So librarians, along with thousands of volunteers, came back to help remove the 700,000 damaged books, along with all the rest of the books in the library that had to go into storage as the building was repaired. The librarians were utterly crushed by this event. I mean, they were in tears watching the fire. And it's not merely that they thought, oh dear, you know, who knows what's going to happen with my job. They were traumatized. They build the collections that exist in their department. It's not, you don't just go to an order form and check a box and get 1,000 books. It's a matter of choosing books and building a collection in a department. And many of them have deep relationships with their patrons. Many of them were traumatized by the thought that their patrons who came to the library regularly would have nowhere to go. So they suffered it deeply, and they hated doing the work that expose them to the aftermath of the fire. I mean, not only because it was dirty and they were worried about the health implications, but also to be wading through these charred remains of what had been their life's work was really disturbing. And many of them suffered what they would consider post-traumatic stress disorder from going through this experience and the aftermath.
I really loved the detail about how the library brought someone in to do guided meditations for coping. And the librarians who were stressed out about how their patrons were doing were instructed to picture them visiting another library branch and being happy.
It was very, you know, it's funny because I loved that notion and how it seems almost charming. And then you realize that these are people who do their work because they really believe in servicing the public. That's why you're a librarian. You don't do it to be rich. You don't do it to be famous. You do it because you really feel this sense of mission to serving people. And they were truly disturbed by the idea that they were not serving their public. And the idea that it would be soothing to them to think, well, they may be going to branch libraries instead, so they're okay. It almost seemed there was something almost funny about how simple this seemed as a way to soothe someone. But I think it was really a genuine feeling of despair that the librarians had, that they were taken away from the people that they believed in serving.
So this also gets at what libraries mean to people, not just the people who work there, but the people who go there.
Libraries are the center of communities in many ways. It's a place through which knowledge and information and stories and narrative and inquiry flows. People gather there. It's the only equivalent that I can think of is a public park. It's a place of gathering that's open to the public and used by all of us.
You write that you grew up in libraries. Can you talk about that? I think a lot of us can really relate.
I started going to the library with my mother when I was really young, probably 4 or 5 is the youngest that I can remember going, but we would go all the time. It was a real ritual. It was a regular part of my day-to-day life that we would go to the library every couple of days and gather up our choices and check them out and go home just savoring them and thinking what order we were going to read our books. And the reason I'm saying we is because my mother would also be taking books out at the same time. And she felt as devoted to libraries as I became. What's interesting is that over time, you know, I moved from the children's section to the teen section and ultimately to the adult section, and tracking my progress through the library in a way is like seeing myself growing up. That was also a place when I was very young that I had a kind of freedom that kids don't really have anywhere other than at home, where I could be unsupervised. And my mother would let me wander off to the kids section by myself. And what a wonderful thing that really you can't do anywhere else when you're 5 years old.
You have a passage that goes on for 5.5 pages. I counted 5.5 pages describing what people are doing outside that central library branch in LA before it opens, and then what they're doing inside the library when they can finally go in. And I mention how many pages it goes on because I want to say not just anyone could pull this off and make it interesting, but it really is.
Well, thank you. I loved writing that section of the book because one of the things that attracted me to the topic was this sense of the flow of humanity through the library. And everybody comes with their own agenda. It's this sort of wonderful, random mix of people who are pursuing completely different thoughts and ideas in the library. And just seeing that range of humanity kind of flowing through struck me as partly just wonderful. I loved seeing it. I loved seeing the slow gathering in the morning before the doors open to the library of this crazy range of people, from school groups to homeless people to businessmen to, you know, you name it. It was every kind of person imaginable, all on their own mission that no two people might have been looking for the same thing in the library. And what a wonderful feeling that is, to see that breadth of human personality types and interests and pursuit. And it just thrilled me. I didn't realize it was 5.5 pages.
And I love there's this, I believe he's a security guard sitting there with a door kind of half open, not even looking up as people ask him again and again, is the library open? Nope. 10 o'clock. Like, just without even looking up, he's having this interaction.
It really was funny, because he just sat there and you could tell he gets asked 20 times every morning, because half of the door is open because the library staff is coming in. They come in earlier, of course, but even though it's posted all over what time the library opens, he would be constantly kind of buffeting people back from the door, saying, nope. It was as if he knew every single person walking up to him was about to say, is the library open yet?
Your central question in the book is why the library never seems to lose relevance as an institution, no matter how much change is happening around it. And I'm curious what you came up with.
I think that the library's meaning to us has changed and keeps changing, but that there is a desire and a need and a kind of yearning for a place that is a hub of our thoughts and knowledge and curiosity. And libraries continue to serve that purpose. And while they may shift from being a place where those interests are served strictly by having books, to their role now where they have books, but they also have classes and they have makerspace and they have computer access and they have many different ways of addressing people's desire to learn and to know.
I was amazed by that in LA, and apparently at a lot of other libraries too, that you can graduate from the library in place of maybe pursuing a GED if you haven't finished high school?
Yeah, LA was the first library to begin a program like this. And it's an online high school that the library administers. You do the classes online and you graduate with a diploma, not with a GED. LA launched this. It was so instantly successful that many libraries across the country have adopted the same kind of program. And it's actually an incredible opportunity. It's meant for not for people to drop out of high school and go online, but instead for adults who never graduated from high school to then return to school via the auspices of the library and get a high school diploma.
Your book kicks off with a few different quotes, and one of them is from Ray Bradbury, who I think of as kind of, when I think about books and Los Angeles, authors from Los Angeles, he comes to mind very quickly, but also he comes to mind very quickly when you talk about books and fires.
He, to me, became the sort of godfather of this book, because he, first of all, was so in love with the LA Public Library, spent so many years there. He didn't go to college. Instead, he just went to the library every day for 13 years straight, as according to his biography. And he believed that the library was basically his university and his the place he grew up. He also was so interested in the idea of books as a sort of fundamental unit in the kind of human experience, and famously wrote Fahrenheit 451 about the very terrifying notion of a society that burns books and that outlaws books. So he used books both for their own, I mean, he loved books and was a huge supporter of libraries in general, and he also wrote with the idea of books as a symbolic embodiment of the freedom of knowledge and information. And it was almost irresistible to keep referring to him in the book because of his connections to not only libraries in general, but to the LA Library in particular. He was, by the way, very involved in helping fundraise to replace the books that were lost in the fire. I mean, he was very actively involved in that and was, of course, horrified by the fire.
Do you have a favorite library story from your own life?
I was remembering the other day, and this was back when I was a kid, and I had been avidly reading books about animals and particularly about horses and all the stuff that kids of a certain age are interested in. And I began having an interest in, I couldn't even quite explain it. I don't know if I was embarrassed to say it or simply couldn't articulate what it was, but I wanted to read something other than books about horses. And one day when I was at the library and I saw one of my favorite librarians, and I must have wandered over and kind of muttered and mumbled something that made her realize that I was looking for books that maybe had romance in them, because I just was too young or too shy to say it outright. And she knew it. She just understood that I wanted to read a book where there were, the notion of romance was the story, as opposed to a girl and her horse. And she led me over to a shelf that had books by Victoria Holt, who wrote these sort of Bronte-esque books, usually about, you know, a young woman working as a nanny in a great house in England who falls in love with the owner of the house. And they're all sort of based on Jane Eyre. When I think about that librarian seeing me struggle to say what I was looking for and just knowing and not making me say it, but instead handing me the book that really was a threshold for me into beginning to read books that were a little more mature and a little bit more sophisticated. And think of what a gift that was to have an adult who understood that and was able to guide me very, very effectively to what I was looking for.
She knew the material, but she also knew the human experience, I guess.
It was wonderful. I don't recall her even saying anything, and instead just standing up from behind her desk and leading me over and handing me this book. And the minute I saw it, I thought, oh, that's what I'm looking for. At an age where it would have been very embarrassing to say, you know, I want a book about, like, romance. I don't think I could have said it at that point.
How do you use the library now that you're a famous author?
Well, I wrote a fair amount of this book in the library. It was a realization that libraries are just perfect co-working spaces, that, and they're free and they're fantastic and they've got fast Wi-Fi and they have smart people working there who can help you if you need someone to point you to some information. So this was a real return to the way I had used libraries, for instance, as I had when I was in college, just at a point when I didn't want to work in my house and didn't really know where I felt like working, and didn't want to sit in a coffee shop and suddenly thought, I could do this in the library.
Susan Orlean, thank you so much.
Such a pleasure to talk to you.
Susan Orlean has a reading in Kansas City tonight. It's a Rainy Day Books event at the Kansas City Public Library's Central Branch. That's the one downtown, and it starts at 6:30. Her new book is called The Library Book, and that's it for today. If you missed anything, you can always grab it at kcur.org/Central Standard. We'll have both of today's conversations ready and available for you shortly. That's also where you can find yesterday's discussion with people from Kansas City's Jewish community, offering insight into what happened in Pittsburgh and how to respond. kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, a local podcast called Creepy in KC. That and other podcast recommendations tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date with Steve Kresge, coming up next.